And our final speaker for the day, Dr. Steve Sanderson, who's the President and CEO of the Wildlife Conservation Society.
Thanks, Bob. And I want to speak to the Manhattan Principles, which is sort of my charge. But first, I want to say something that I feel very deeply, and that is that the reason that we have been able to do whatever it is that we've done at the Wildlife Conservation Society is because of the history of the New York Zoological Society. We've been around since 1895, and we were created by the city fathers in the great era of urban progressivism in the 19th century, when people in New York and elsewhere in London and Paris and Hamburg and other cities around the world felt that the city was the greatest expression of civilization. And in order to be a great city, one had to have a great botanical garden and a great museum of natural history and a great zoological garden. And we were created for that purpose, as a pleasuring ground for the citizens of this city and those who might care to visit it. And secondly, as a place where animals would be well cared for and displayed for the pleasure of people and for our own erudition. And third and importantly, where we could engage in the conservation of wildlife species at that time in North America. And that was in 1895, and we opened at the Bronx in 1897, and by 1903 we had gone international. But before we went international, and it was William Beebe who went to Mexico in 1903 to look at the problems of the disappearance of migratory songbirds from the Northeast. Before we went international, we had the first veterinary clinician in any American zoo. And it was because animal well-being stood at the top of our priorities, and because there was a process in which the 19th century amateur naturalism that governed the passion to create such a thing as the New York Zoological Society, it was transitioning into a scientific perspective on animal well-being and conservation in the field. And so I want to just say that by way of a commercial. Because I think the Bronx Zoo and the New York Zoological Society have, throughout the course of this time, been really noble institutions that have served humanity well, and I'm proud to be associated with them. Now to the... I got this impossible task, which I got this very articulate Manhattan Principles, which goes two pages and has 12 principles and then a bunch of paragraphs around it that seem to be just fine. And they have a lot of action verbs that are recognizing, including, and acting on, and restricting, and increasing, and forming, and providing, and investing, and stuff. And I don't have any better verbs than that. But I want to take that through the filter of the day and reduce it to 8 propositions. So we're down from 12, and that will be faster, for one thing. And one is that there is no doubt that the linkage is necessary. We need to link across disciplines. And you know, I lived my life as a kind of a disciplinary hybrid in the academy and in Latin America and so forth. And everyone was always talking about multidisciplinarity. And what that is really it's just kind of scrambled eggs. And what we need is what H.T. Odum used to call a transdiscipline. The disciplines are inventions of a time in the academy, and what we need to do is to transcend those, not out of our own curiosity, but out of human need. And our conservation work and the subject of the conference today really were about human need, not human curiosity, although it's really curious, the need. So we need to create a transdiscipline, and we need to transcend our entrepreneurial and enterprise boundaries. We really are not very good at working together, as hard as we try. And I just came from meeting after meeting around the world in which we were all bent on and flew thousands upon thousands of miles to collaborate together, and mainly it was really very hard. And at the margins, we do okay, but we don't take the bit in our teeth and say the purpose of the collaboration is to solve a great problem or to engage in a great quest. It can't be to defend our institutions. We need to brand the solution and not our own institutions. And then finally, we have to do this around the world, which is not easy because of what the postmodernists would call cultural incommensurability. which means it's hard to talk across cultures. But that doesn't sound nearly as interesting to a postmodernist as the other. So those linkages are essential, and they have to be profound and not ephemeral. Secondly, the loss of wildlife is a loss to the integrity of life on Earth. Third, that conservation, and these are propositions because, first of all, I really can't falsify them, and secondly, they're not put together with an eye toward skepticism. They're argumentative. You may have noticed that. So this is actually a hypothesis, though, that conservation can lead to an improvement in human well-being. This is the sustainability hypothesis written one way. The flip of that is that human health can lead to conservation. And if we use Kent Redford's very unhappy and kind of slightly scary quote from the cardinal of France in the medieval time who was going to smite the slugs, there is a set of propositions. The incentives to smite are inversely related to human health. And the incentives to smite are directly related to human illness. So the blame game and the eradication of wild populations or domestic populations or the striking out by humanity against animals is really a function of our concept of human well-being or clinical pathology or a positive vision versus a negative vision. I want to just say a word about the surveillance gap because everybody's been talking about it. And the thing that has not been said is that closing that gap, those gaps, are consistent with two other great values, one of which is enhancing the body of human knowledge, and second, consistent with conservation. These are convergent agendas. The surveillance capability that we so sorely need for our own survival, the enhancement of human knowledge and the prospects for conservation should walk hand in hand, in hand. The fifth is, and we kind of have been uneven on this today, we have an obligation. I feel this obligation. I think our scientists and our conservation practitioners around the world feel the obligation to speak truth to power. We can't equivocate. We can't flip-flop. We can't say we don't know enough to do this. And on the other hand, we have to be humble in the face of those of answering those questions. So that if the truth that we speak to power is that we simply can't make a good recommendation, we need to be humble enough to say so. But we have to follow that by saying what it is that would allow us to make a sound recommendation and how to get there. So it can't be a cop-out. And on the other hand, if somebody looks me in the eye and says, "What do you think?" and I have to answer by saying, "Gee, what's the truth as I know it versus what is the answer that is likely to get me funded?" I am a bad man. And I cannot think that way. I've got to be able to speak clearly on the evidence according to our mission institutionally, according to what we know, and not allow our enterprise collectively to become a political product. Six in this list of eight, I know you must be counting, One Health, One World, One Health is a biotic and human capital investment, and its payout will be long and rich over time. So it is a winning proposition. It is not a defensive action to reduce the incidence of bad things. It is a positive statement about the future of our Earth. Seventh, it is a noble quest, but it is not an academic exercise. What we have been talking about today and what people have committed professionally to in the course of the presentations and in your institutional roles and by coming here and sitting and listening and being so patient and quiet and attentive and long-suffering, you have committed to, this is not just an exercise for our entertainment, it's really important. And eighth, come to the Bronx Zoo. It's a wonderful place, and it is where 4 million or 2 million people at the Bronx, 2 million people come every year to be reminded that they live alienated from nature. But in that place, in that pleasuring ground, those 265 acres, you can come nose to nose with the greatest animals in the world who are living in good, healthy, rich conditions, and you can be awed by them and remember the depth of the connection between wild nature and the survival of human culture. Thank you.